it? You're keeping secrets from me. He raised his brows. Did you think I told you everything?
Of course not, she scowled. But I thought Penelope did.
But this isn't my secret to tell, Penelope said. It's Colin's.
I think the planet has shifted on its axis, Eloise grumbled. Or perhaps England has crashed into France. All I know is this is not the same world I inhabited just this morning.
Penelope couldn't help it. She giggled.
And you're laughing at me, Eloise added. No, I'm not, Penelope said, laughing. Really, I'm not.
Do you know what you need? Colin asked.
Me?
Eloise queried. He nodded. A husband.
You're as bad as mother.
I could be a lot worse if I really put my mind to it.
Of that I have no doubt, Eloise shot back. Stop! Stop!
Penelope said, truly laughing in earnest now. They both looked at her expectantly, as if to say, now what?
I'm so glad I came tonight, Penelope said, the words tumbling unbidden from her lips. I can't remember a nicer evening. Truly, I can't.
Several hours later, as Colin was lying in bed, staring up at the ceiling in the bedroom of his new flat in Bloomsbury, it occurred to him that he felt the exact same way. Chapter 8. Colin Bridgerton and Penelope Featherington were seen in conversation at the Smythe Smith Musicale, although no one seems to know what exactly they were discussing. This author would venture to guess that their conversation centred upon this author's identity, since that was what everyone else seemed to be talking about before, after, and rather rudely, in this author's esteemed opinion, during the performance. In other news, Honoria Smythe-Smith's violin was damaged when Lady Danbury accidentally knocked it off a table while waving her cane. Lady Danbury insisted upon replacing the instrument, but then declared that as it is not her habit to buy anything but the best, Honoria will have a Ruggieri violin imported from Cremona, Italy. It is this author's understanding that, when one factors in manufacture and shipping time, along with a lengthy waiting list, it takes 6 months for a Ruggieri violin to reach our shores. Lady Whistledown's Society Papers, 16th of April, 1824. There are moments in a woman's life when her heart flips in her chest, when the world suddenly seems uncommonly pink and perfect, when a symphony can be heard in the tinkle of a doorbell. Penelope Featherington had just such a moment 2 days after the Smythe Smith Musicale. All it took was a knock on her bedroom door, followed by her butler's voice informing her, "Mr. Colin Bridgerton is here to see you." Penelope tumbled right off the bed. Brierly, who had butlered for the Featherington family long enough so that he did not even so much as bat an eyelash at Penelope's clumsiness, murmured, "Shall I tell him you are not in?"
"No!"
Penelope nearly shrieked, stumbling to her feet.
"I mean, no,"
she added in a more reasonable voice.
"But I will require 10 minutes to prepare myself."
She glanced in the mirror and winced at her dishevelled appearance.
15.
"As you wish, Miss Penelope."
"Oh, and make certain to prepare a tray of food. Mr. Bridgerton is sure to be hungry. He's always hungry."
The butler nodded again. Penelope stood stock still as Brierly disappeared out the door, then, completely unable to contain herself, danced from foot to foot, emitting a strange squealing sort of noise, one that she was convinced, or at least hoped, had never before crossed her lips. Then again, she couldn't remember the last time a gentleman had called upon her, much less the one with whom she'd been desperately in love for almost half of her life.
"Settle down,"
she said, spreading her fingers and pressing her flattened palms out in much the same motion she might make if she were trying to placate a small, unruly crowd.
"You must remain calm. Calm,"
she repeated, as if that would actually do the trick.
Calm.
But inside, her heart was dancing. She took a few deep breaths, walked over to her dressing table, and picked up her hairbrush. It would only take a few minutes to repin her hair. Surely Colin wasn't going to flee if she kept him waiting for a short while. He'd expect her to take a bit of time to ready herself, wouldn't he? But still, she found herself fixing her hair in record time, and by the time she stepped through the sitting room door, a mere 5 minutes had passed since the butler's announcement.
"That was quick," Colin said with a quirky grin.
He'd been standing by the window, peering out at Mount Street.
"Oh, was it?"
Penelope said, hoping that the heat she felt on her skin wasn't translating into a blush. A woman was supposed to keep a gentleman waiting, although not too long. Still, it made no sense to hold to such silly behaviour with Colin, of all people. He would never be interested in her in a romantic fashion, and besides, they were friends. Friends. It seemed like such an odd concept, and yet that was exactly what they were. They'd always been friendly acquaintances, but since his return from Cyprus, they'd become friends in truth. It was magical. Even if he never loved her, and she rather thought he never would, this was better than what they'd had before.
"To what do I owe the pleasure?"
she asked, taking a seat on her mother's slightly faded yellow damask sofa. Colin sat across from her in a rather uncomfortable straight-backed chair. He leaned forward, resting his hands on his knees, and Penelope knew instantly that something was wrong. It simply wasn't the pose a gentleman adopted for a regular social call. He looked too distraught, too intense.
"It's rather serious," he said, his face grim.
Penelope nearly rose to her feet.
"Has something happened? Is someone ill?"
"No, no, nothing like that."
He paused, let out a long breath, then raked his hand through his already mussed-up hair.
"It's about Eloise."
"What is it?"
"I don't know how to say this. Do you have anything to eat?"
Penelope was ready to wring his neck.
"For heaven's sake, Colin."
"Sorry," he muttered. "I haven't eaten all day."
"A first, I'm sure," Penelope said impatiently. "I already told Briley to fix a tray. Now, will you just tell me what is wrong? Or do you plan to wait until I expire of impatience?"
"I think she's Lady Whistledown,"
he blurted out. Penelope's mouth fell open. She wasn't sure what she'd expected him to say, but it wasn't this.
"Penelope, did you hear me?"
"Eloise?"
she asked, even though she knew exactly who he was talking about. He nodded.
"She can't be."
He stood and began to pace, too full of nervous energy to sit still.
"Why not?"
Because...
"Because why?"
"Because there is no way she could have done that for 10 years without my knowing."
His expression went from disturbed to disdainful in an instant.
"I hardly think you're privy to everything that Eloise does."
"Of course not,"
Penelope replied, giving him a rather irritated look.
"But I can tell you with absolute certainty that there is no way Eloise could keep a secret of that magnitude from me for over 10 years. She's simply not capable of it."
"Penelope, she's the nosiest person I know."
"Well, that much is true," Penelope agreed. "Except for my mother, I suppose. But that's hardly enough to convict her."
Colin stopped his pacing and planted his hands on his hips.
"She is always writing things down."
"Why would you think that?"
He held up his hand, rubbing his thumb briskly against his fingertips.
"Ink stains, constantly."
"Lots of people use pen and ink."
Penelope motioned broadly at Colin.
"You write in journals? I'm certain you've had your share of ink on your fingers."
"Yes, but I don't disappear when I write in my journals."
Penelope felt her pulse quicken.
"What do you mean?"
she asked, her voice growing breathless.
"I mean that she locks herself in her room for hours on end, and it's after those periods that her fingers are covered with ink."
Penelope didn't say anything for an agonizingly long moment. Colin's evidence was damning indeed, especially when combined with Eloise's well-known and well-documented penchant for nosiness. But she wasn't Lady Whistledown. She couldn't be. Penelope would bet her life on it. Finally, Penelope just crossed her arms, and in a tone of voice that probably would have been more at home on an exceedingly stubborn 6-year-old, said, "It's not her. It's not." Colin sat back down, looking defeated.
"I wish I could share your certainty."
"Colin, you need to..."
"Where the hell is the food?"
he grumbled. She should have been shocked, but somehow his lack of manners amused her. "I'm sure Brierly will be here shortly."
He sprawled into a chair. "I'm hungry."
"Yes," Penelope said, lips twitching. "I surmised as much."
He sighed, weary and worried. "If she's Lady Whistledown, it'll be a disaster. A pure, unmitigated disaster."
"It wouldn't be that bad," Penelope said carefully. "Not that I think she's Lady Whistledown, because I don't. But truly, if she were, would it be so very dreadful? I rather like Lady Whistledown myself."
"Yes, Penelope," Colin said rather sharply. "It would be so very dreadful. She'd be ruined."
"I don't think she'd be ruined."
"Of course she'd be ruined. Do you have any idea how many people that woman has insulted over the years?"
"I didn't realise you hated Lady Whistledown so much," Penelope said.
"I don't hate her," Colin said impatiently. "It doesn't matter if I hate her. Everyone else hates her."
"I don't think that's true. They all buy her paper."
"Of course they buy her paper. Everyone buys her bloody paper."
"Colin."
"Sorry," he muttered, but it didn't really sound like he meant it. Penelope nodded her acceptance of his apology. "Whoever that Lady Whistledown is," Colin said, shaking his finger at her with such vehemence that she actually lurched backward, "when she is unmasked, she will not be able to show her face in London." Penelope delicately cleared her throat.
"I didn't realise you cared so much about the opinions of society."
"I don't," he retorted. "Well, not much, at least. Anyone who tells you they don't care at all is a liar and a hypocrite."
Penelope rather thought he was correct, but she was surprised he'd admitted it. It seemed men always liked to pretend that they were wholly self-contained, completely unaffected by the whims and opinions of society.
Colin leaned forward, his green eyes burning with intensity. "This isn't about me, Penelope. It's about Eloise. And if she is cast out of society, she will be crushed." He sat back, but his entire body radiated tension, "not to mention what it would do to my mother."
Penelope let out a long breath. "I really think you're getting upset over nothing," she said.
"I hope you're right," he replied, closing his eyes.
He wasn't sure when he'd started to suspect that his sister might be Lady Whistledown. Probably after Lady Danbury had issued her now famous challenge. Unlike most of London, Colin had never been terribly interested in Lady Whistledown's true identity. The column was entertaining, and he certainly read it along with everyone else. But to his mind, Lady Whistledown was simply Lady Whistledown, and that was all she needed to be. But Lady Danbury's dare had started him thinking, and, like the rest of the Bridgertons, once he got hold of an idea, he was fundamentally incapable of letting it go. Somehow, it had occurred to him that Eloise had the perfect temperament and skills to write such a column, and then, before he could convince himself that he was crazy, he'd seen the ink spots on her fingers. Since then, he'd gone nearly mad, unable to think about anything but the possibility that Eloise had a secret life. He didn't know which irritated him more, that Eloise might be Lady Whistledown, or that she had managed to hide it from him for over a decade. How galling, to be hoodwinked by one's sister. He liked to think himself smarter than that.
but he needed to focus on the present. Because if his suspicions were correct, how on earth were they going to deal with the scandal when she was discovered? And she would be discovered. With all of London lusting after the £1,000 prize, Lady Whistledown didn't stand a chance.
Colin? Colin?
He opened his eyes, wondering how long Penelope had been calling his name.
I really think you should stop worrying about Eloise, she said. There are hundreds and hundreds of people in London. Lady Whistledown could be any one of them. Heavens, with your eye for detail...
She waggled her fingers to remind him of Eloise's ink-stained fingertips.
You could be Lady Whistledown.
He shot her a rather condescending look. Except for the small detail of my having been out of the country half the time. Penelope chose to ignore his sarcasm.
You're certainly a good enough writer to carry it off.
Colin had intended to say something droll and slightly gruff, dismissing her rather weak arguments. But the truth was, he was so secretly delighted about her good writer compliment that all he could do was sit there with a loopy smile on his face.
"Are you all right?" Penelope asked.
"Perfectly fine," he replied, snapping to attention and trying to adopt a more sober mien. "Why would you ask?"
"Because you suddenly looked quite ill. Dizzy, actually."
"I'm fine," he repeated, probably a little louder than was necessary. "I'm just thinking about the scandal." She let out a beleaguered sigh, which irritated him, because he didn't see that she had any reason to feel so impatient with him.
"What scandal?" she asked.
"The scandal that is going to erupt when she is discovered," he ground out.
"She's not Lady Whistledown," she insisted.
Colin suddenly sat up straight, his eyes alight with a new idea. "Do you know?" he said, in a rather intense sort of voice. "But I don't think it matters if she is Lady Whistledown or not." Penelope stared at him blankly for a full 3 seconds before looking about the room, muttering,
"Where's the food? I must be light-headed. Haven't you spent the last 10 minutes positively going mad over the possibility that she is?"
As if on cue, Brierly entered the room with a heavily laden tray. Penelope and Colin watched in silence as the butler laid out the meal.
"Would you like me to fix your plates?" he inquired.
"No, that's quite all right," Penelope said quickly. "We can manage for ourselves."
Brierly nodded, and, as soon as he'd laid the flatware and filled the 2 glasses with lemonade, left the room.
"Listen to me,"
Colin said, jumping to his feet and moving the door so that it almost rested against the doorframe but remained technically open should anyone quibble about proprieties.
"Don't you want something to eat?"
Penelope inquired, holding aloft a plate that she'd filled with various small snacks. He snatched a piece of cheese, ate it in 2 rather indelicate bites, then continued,
"Even if Eloise isn't Lady Whistledown, and mind you, I still think she is, it doesn't matter, because if I suspect that she's Lady Whistledown, then surely someone else will as well."
"Your point being?"
Colin realised that his arms were reaching forward, and he stopped himself before he reached out to shake her shoulders.
"It doesn't matter. Don't you see? If someone points his finger at her, she'll be ruined."
"But not,"
Penelope said, appearing to require a great deal of effort to unclench her teeth.
"If she's not Lady Whistledown."
"How could she prove it?"
Colin returned, jumping to his feet.
"Once a rumour is started, the damage is done. It develops a life of its own."
"Colin, you ceased to make sense 5 minutes ago."
"No, hear me out."
He whirled to face her, and he was seized by a feeling of such intensity that he couldn't have ripped his eyes from hers if the house were falling down around them.
"Suppose I told everyone that I had seduced you."
Penelope grew very, very still.
"You would be ruined forever,"
he continued, crouching down near the edge of the sofa so that they were more on the same level.
"It wouldn't matter that we had never even kissed. That, my dear Penelope, is the power of the word. She looked oddly frozen, and at the same time flushed.
I don't know what to say, she stammered.
And then the most bizarre thing happened. He realized that he didn't know what to say either, because he'd forgotten about rumors and the power of the word and all of that rot, and the only thing he could think of was the part about the kissing. And good God in heaven, he wanted to kiss Penelope Featherington. Penelope Featherington. He might as well have said he wanted to kiss his sister. Except, he stole a glance at her. She looked uncommonly fetching, and he wondered how he hadn't noticed that earlier that afternoon. She wasn't his sister. She definitely wasn't his sister. Colin? His name was a mere whisper on her lips. Her eyes were quite adorably blinking and befuddled. And how was it he'd never noticed what an intriguing shade of brown they were? Almost gold near the pupil. He'd never seen anything like it. And yet it wasn't as if he hadn't seen her 100 times before. He stood, suddenly, drunkenly. Best if they weren't quite on the same latitude. Harder to see her eyes from up here. She stood too. Damn it. Colin, she asked, her voice barely audible. Could I ask you a favour? Call it male intuition. Call it insanity. But a very insistent voice inside of him was screaming that whatever she wanted had to be a very bad idea. He was, however, an idiot. He had to be, because he felt his lips part. And then he heard a voice that sounded an awful lot like his own say, "Of course." Her lips puckered, and for a moment he thought she was trying to kiss him. But then he realized that she was just bringing them together to form a word. Would. Just a word. Nothing but a word beginning with W. W always looked like a kiss.
Would you kiss me?
Chapter 9. Every week there seems to be one invitation that is coveted above all others, and this week's prize must surely go to the Countess of Macclesfield, who is hosting a grand ball on Monday night. Lady Macclesfield is not a frequent hostess here in London, but she is very popular, as is her husband, and it is expected that a great many bachelors plan to attend, including Mr. Colin Bridgerton. Assuming he does not collapse from exhaustion after 4 days with the 10 Bridgerton grandchildren, Viscount Berwick and Mr. Michael Anstruther Weatherby. This author anticipates that a great many young and unmarried ladies will choose to attend as well, following the publication of this column. Lady Whistledown's Society Papers, 16th of April, 1824. His life, as he knew it, was over. What? He asked, aware that he was blinking rapidly. Her face turned a deeper shade of crimson than he'd thought humanly possible, and she turned away.
Never mind, she mumbled. Forget I said anything.
Colin thought that a very good idea. But then, just when he'd thought that his world might resume its normal course, or at least that he'd be able to pretend it had, she whirled back around, her eyes alight with a passionate fire that astonished him.
No, I'm not going to forget it, she cried out. I've spent my life forgetting things, not saying them, never telling anyone what I really want.
Colin tried to say something, but it was clear to him that his throat had begun to close. Any minute now he'd be dead. He was sure of it.
It won't mean a thing, she said. I promise you it won't mean anything, and I'd never expect anything from you because of it. But I could die tomorrow and...
What? Her eyes looked huge and meltingly dark and pleading, and he could feel his resolve melting away.
I'm 28, she said, her voice soft and sad. I'm an old maid, and I've never been kissed.
He knew how to speak. He was fairly certain he'd been perfectly articulate just minutes earlier. But now he didn't seem able to form a word. And Penelope kept talking, her cheeks delightfully pink, and her lips moving so quickly that he couldn't help but wonder what they'd feel like on his skin, on his neck, on his shoulder, on his other places.
"I'm going to be an old maid at 29, she said, "and I'll be an old maid at 30. I could die tomorrow and..."
"You're not going to die tomorrow,"
he somehow managed to get out. "But I could. I could. And it would kill me because..."
"You'd already be dead," he said, thinking his voice sounded rather strange and disembodied.
"I don't want to die without ever having been kissed," she finally finished.
Colin could think of 100 reasons why kissing Penelope Featherington was a very bad idea, the number one being that he actually wanted to kiss her. He opened his mouth, hoping that a sound would emerge, and that it might actually be intelligible speech. But there was nothing, just the sound of breath on his lips. And then Penelope did the one thing that could break his resolve in an instant. She looked up at him, deeply into his eyes, and uttered one simple word.
"Please."
He was lost. There was something heartbreaking in the way she was gazing at him, as if she might die if he didn't kiss her. Not from heartbreak, not from embarrassment. It was almost as if she needed him for nourishment, to feed her soul, to fill her heart. And Colin couldn't remember anyone else ever needing him with such fervour. It humbled him. It made him want her with an intensity that nearly buckled his knees. He looked at her, and somehow he didn't see the woman he'd seen so many times before. She was different. She glowed. She was a siren, a goddess, and he wondered how on earth no one had ever noticed this before.
"Colin,"
she whispered. He took a step forward, barely a half a foot, but it was close enough so that when he touched her chin and tipped her face up, her lips were mere inches from his. Their breath mingled, and the air grew hot and heavy. Penelope was trembling. He could feel that under his fingers, but he wasn't so sure that he wasn't trembling too. He assumed he'd say something flip and droll, like the devil-may-care fellow he was reputed to be. "Anything for you, perhaps? Or maybe every woman deserves at least one kiss?" But as he closed the bare distance between them, he realized that there were no words that could capture the intensity of the moment. No words for the passion, no words for the need, no words for the sheer epiphany of the moment. And so, on an otherwise unremarkable Friday afternoon, in the heart of Mayfair, in a quiet drawing room on Mount Street, Colin Bridgerton kissed Penelope Featherington. And it was glorious. His lips touched hers softly at first, not because he was trying to be gentle, although if he'd had the presence of mind to think about such things, it probably would have occurred to him that this was her first kiss, and it ought to be reverent and beautiful, and all the things a girl dreams about as she's lying in bed at night. But in all truth, none of that was on Colin's mind. In fact, he was thinking of quite little. His kiss was soft and gentle, because he was still so surprised that he was kissing her. He'd known her for years, had never even thought about touching his lips to hers, and now he couldn't have let her go if the fires of hell were licking his toes. He could barely believe what he was doing, or that he wanted to do it so damned much. It wasn't the sort of a kiss one initiates because one is overcome with passion, or emotion, or anger, or desire. It was a slower thing, a learning experience, for Colin just as much as for Penelope. And he was learning that everything he thought he'd known about kissing was rubbish. Everything else had been mere lips and tongue,
and softly murmured but meaningless words. This was a kiss. There was something in the friction, the way he could hear and feel her breath at the same time. Something in the way she held perfectly still, and yet he could feel her heart pounding through her skin. There was something in the fact that he knew it was her. Colin moved his lips slightly to the left, until he was nipping the corner of her mouth, softly tickling the very spot where her lips joined. His tongue dipped and traced, learning the contours of her mouth, tasting the sweet, salty essence of her. This was more than a kiss. His hands, which had been lightly splayed against her back, drew rigid, more tense, as they pressed into the fabric of her dress. He could feel the heat of her under his fingertips, seeping up through the muslin, swirling in the delicate muscles of her back. He drew her to him, pulling her closer, closer, until their bodies were pressed together. He could feel her, the entire length of her, and it set him on fire. He was growing hard, and he wanted her. Dear God, how he wanted her! His mouth grew more insistent, and his tongue darted forward, nudging her until her lips parted. He swallowed her soft moan of acquiescence, then pushed forward to taste her. She was sweet, and a little tart from the lemonade, and she was clearly as intoxicating as fine brandy, because Colin was starting to doubt his ability to remain on his feet. He moved his hands along the length of her, slowly, so as not to frighten her. She was soft, curvy, and lush, just as he'd always thought a woman should be. Her hips flared, and her bottom was perfect, and her breasts, good God, her breasts felt good pressing against his chest. His palms itched to cup them, but he forced his hands to remain where they were, rather enjoyably on her derriere, so it really wasn't that much of a sacrifice. Beside the fact that he really shouldn't be groping a gently bred lady's breasts in the middle of her drawing room, he had a rather painful suspicion that if he touched her in that way, he would lose himself completely. Penelope, Penelope, he murmured, wondering why her name tasted so good on his lips. He was ravenous for her, heady and drugged by passion, and he wanted desperately for her to feel the same way. She felt perfect in his arms, but thus far she had made no reaction. Oh, she had swayed in his arms and opened her mouth to welcome his sweet invasion, but other than that she had done nothing. And yet, from the pant of her breath and the beat of her heart, he knew that she was aroused. He pulled back just a few inches so that he could touch her chin and tilt her face up toward his. Her eyelids fluttered open, revealing eyes that were dazed with passion, perfectly matching her lips, which were lightly parted, completely soft and thoroughly swollen from his kisses. She was beautiful, utterly, completely, soul-stirringly beautiful. He didn't know how he hadn't noticed it all these years. Was the world populated with blind men, or merely stupid ones? "You can kiss me too," he whispered, leaning his forehead lightly against hers. She did nothing but blink. "A kiss," he murmured, lowering his lips to hers again, although just for a fleeting moment, "is for two people." Her hand stirred at his back. "What do I do?" she whispered. "Whatever you want to do." Slowly, tentatively, she lifted one of her hands to his face. Her fingers trailed lightly over his cheek, skimming along the line of his jaw until they fell away. "Thank you," she whispered. "Thank you?" He went still. It was exactly the wrong thing to say. He didn't want to be thanked for his kiss. It made him feel guilty. And shallow. As if it had been something done out of pity. And the worst part was, he knew that if all this had come to pass only a few months earlier, it would have been out of pity. What the hell did that say about him? "Don't thank me," he said gruffly, shoving himself backward until they were no longer touching.
But I said don't,
he repeated harshly, turning away as if he couldn't bear the sight of her, when the truth was that he couldn't quite bear himself. And the damnedest thing was, he wasn't sure why. This desperate, gnawing feeling. Was it guilt? Because he shouldn't have kissed her? Because he shouldn't have liked it?
Colin, she said, don't be angry with yourself.
I'm not, he snapped.
I asked you to kiss me. I practically forced you.
Now there was a surefire way to make a man feel manly.
You didn't force me, he bit off.
No, but...
For the love of God, Penelope, enough!
She drew back, her eyes wide.
I'm sorry,
she whispered. He looked down at her hands. They were shaking. He closed his eyes in agony. Why was he being such an ass?
Penelope,
he began.
No, it's all right, she said, her words rushed. You don't have to say anything.
No, I should.
I really wish you wouldn't.
And now she looked so quietly dignified, which made him feel even worse. She was standing there, her hands clasped demurely in front of her, her eyes downward, not quite on the floor, but not on his face. She thought he'd kissed her out of pity. And he was a knave, because a small part of him wanted her to think that. Because if she thought it, then maybe he could convince himself that it was true, that it was just pity, that it couldn't possibly be more.
I should go, he said,
the words quiet, and yet still too loud in the silent room. She didn't try to stop him. He motioned to the door.
I should go, he said again,
even as his feet refused to move. She nodded.
I didn't,
he started to say, and then, horrified by the words that had nearly come out of his mouth, he actually did head toward the door. But Penelope called out. Of course she called out.
You didn't what?
And he didn't know what to say, because what he'd started to say was, I didn't kiss you out of pity. If he wanted her to know that, if he wanted to convince himself of that, then that could only mean that he craved her good opinion, which could only mean...
I have to go,
he blurted out, desperate now, as if leaving the room might be the only way to keep his thoughts from travelling down such a dangerous road. He crossed the remaining distance to the door, waiting for her to say something, to call out his name. But she didn't, and he left, and he'd never hated himself more. Colin was in an exceedingly bad mood before the footman showed up at his front door with a summons from his mother. Afterward, he was beyond repair. Bloody hell. She was going to start in on him again about getting married. Her summonses were always about getting married, and he really wasn't in the mood for it right now. But she was his mother, and he loved her, and that meant he couldn't very well ignore her. So, with considerable grumbling and a fair bit of cursing while he was at it, he yanked on his boots and coat and headed out the door. He was living in Bloomsbury, not the most fashionable section of town for a member of the aristocracy, although Bedford Square, where he had taken out a lease on a small but elegant terrace house, was certainly an upscale and respectable address. Colin rather liked living in Bloomsbury, where his neighbours were doctors and lawyers and scholars and people who actually did things other than attend party after party. He wasn't ready to trade in his heritage for a life in trade. It was rather good to be a Bridgerton after all, but there was something stimulating about watching professional men going about their daily business, the lawyers heading east to the Inns of the Court, the doctors northwest to Portland Place. It would have been easy enough to drive his curricle across town. It had only been brought back to the mews an hour ago upon his return from the Featheringtons. But Colin was feeling a bit in need of some fresh air, not to mention perverse enough to take the slowest means possible to number 5. If his mother intended to deliver another lecture on the virtues of marriage, followed by a lengthy dissertation on the attributes of each and every eligible miss in London, she could bloody well wait for him. Colin closed his eyes and groaned. His mood must be worse than even he had thought, if he was cursing in relation to his mother, whom he and all the Bridgertons really held in the highest esteem and affection. It was Penelope's fault. No, it was Eloise's fault, he thought, grinding his teeth. Better to blame a sibling. No, he slumped back into his desk chair, groaning. It was his fault. If he was in a bad mood, if he was ready to yank someone's head off with his bare hands, it was his fault and his fault alone. He shouldn't have kissed Penelope. It didn't matter that he'd wanted to kiss her, even though he hadn't even realised that he wanted to until right before she'd mentioned it. He still shouldn't have kissed her. Although, when he really thought about it, he wasn't quite sure why he shouldn't have kissed her. He stood, then trudged to the window and let his forehead rest against the pane. Bedford Square was quiet, with only a few men walking along the pavement. Labourers they looked to be, probably working on the new museum being built just to the east. It was why Colin had taken a house on the west side of the square. The construction could get very noisy. His gaze travelled north, to the statue of Charles James Fox. Now there was a man with a purpose. Led the Whigs for years. He hadn't always been very well liked, if some of the older members of the Ton were to be believed. But Colin was coming to think that perhaps being well-liked was overrated. Heaven knew that no one was better liked than he was, and look at him now, frustrated and malcontent, grumpy and ready to lash out at anyone who crossed his path. He sighed, planting one hand on the window frame and pushing himself back to an upright position. He'd better get going, especially if he was planning to walk all the way to Mayfair. Although, in truth, it really wasn't that far. Probably not more than 30 minutes if he kept his pace brisk, and he always did. Less if the pavements weren't littered with slow people. It was longer than most members of the Ton cared to be outside in London, unless they were shopping or fashionably strolling in the park. But Colin felt the need to clear his head. And if the air in London wasn't particularly fresh, well, it would still have to do. His luck, that day being what it was, however, by the time he reached the intersection of Oxford and Regent Streets, the first splats of raindrops began to dance against his face. By the time he was turning off Hanover Square onto St. George Street, it was pouring in earnest, and he was just close enough to Bruton Street that it would have been really ridiculous to have tried to hail a hackney to take him the rest of the way. So he walked on. After the first minute or so of annoyance, however, the rain began to feel oddly good. It was warm enough out that it didn't chill him to the bone, and the fat, wet sting of it almost felt like a penance. And he felt like maybe that was what he deserved. The door to his mother's house opened before Colin's foot had even found the top step. Wickham must have been waiting for him.
"Might I suggest a towel?"
the butler intoned, handing him a large white cloth. Colin took it, wondering how on earth Wickham had had time to get a towel. He couldn't have known that Colin would be fool enough to walk in the rain. Not for the first time. It occurred to Colin that butlers must be possessed of strange, mystical powers. Perhaps it was a job requirement. Colin used the towel to dry his hair, causing great consternation to Wickham, who was terribly proper, and surely expected Colin to retire to a private room for at least a half an hour to mend his appearance.
"Where's my mother?"
Colin asked. Wickham's lips tightened, and he looked pointedly down at Colin's feet, which were now creating small puddles.
"She is in her office," he replied, "but she is speaking with your sister."
"Which sister?" Colin asked, keeping a sunny smile on his face, just to annoy Wickham, who had surely been trying to annoy him by omitting his sister's name. As if you could simply say, "Your sister," to a Bridgerton, and expect him to know who you were talking about.
Francesca.
Ah, yes. She's returning to Scotland soon, isn't she?
Tomorrow.
Colin handed the towel back to Wickham, who regarded it as he might a large insect.
I won't bother her, then. Just let her know I'm here when she's done with Francesca.
Wickham nodded.
Would you care to change your clothes, Mr. Bridgerton? I believe we have some of your brother Gregory's garments upstairs in his bedchamber.
Colin found himself smiling. Gregory was finishing up his final term at Cambridge. He was 11 years younger than Colin, and it was difficult to believe they could actually share clothing. But he supposed it was time to accept that his little brother had finally grown up.
That's an excellent idea, Colin said.
He gave his sodden sleeve a rueful glance.
I'll leave these here to be cleaned and fetch them later.
Wickham nodded again, murmured,
As you wish,
and disappeared down the hall to parts unknown. Colin took the steps two at a time up to the family quarters. As he sloshed down the hall, he heard the sound of a door opening. Turning around, he saw that it was Eloise, not the person he wanted to see. She immediately brought back all the memories of his afternoon with Penelope, their conversation, the kiss, especially the kiss, and even worse, the guilt he'd felt afterward, the guilt he still felt.
Colin, Eloise said brightly, I didn't realise you... What did you do? Walk?
He shrugged.
I like the rain.
She eyed him curiously, her head cocking to the side, as it always did when she was puzzling through something.
You're in a rather odd mood today.
I'm soaking wet, Eloise.
No need to snap at me about it,
she said with a sniff.
I didn't force you to walk across town in the rain.
It wasn't raining when I left,
he felt rather compelled to say. There was something about a sibling that brought out the 8-year-old in a body.
I'm sure the sky was grey,
she returned. Clearly, she had a bit of the 8-year-old in her as well.
May we continue this discussion when I'm dry?
He asked, his voice deliberately impatient.
Of course,
she said expansively, all accommodation.
I'll wait for you right here.
Colin took his time while he changed into Gregory's clothes, taking more care with his cravat than he had in years. Finally, when he was convinced that Eloise must be grinding her teeth, he re-entered the hall.
I heard you went to see Penelope today,
she said without preamble. Wrong thing to say.
Where did you hear that?
He asked carefully. He knew that his sister and Penelope were close, but surely Penelope wouldn't have told Eloise about that.
Felicity told Hyacinth.
And Hyacinth told you?
Of course.
Something, Colin muttered, has got to be done about all the gossip in this town.
I hardly think this counts as gossip, Colin, Eloise said. It's not as if you're interested in Penelope.
If she had been talking about any other woman, Colin would have expected her to give him a sidelong glance, followed by a coy, Are you? But this was Penelope, and even though Eloise was her very best friend, and thus her finest champion, even she couldn't imagine that a man of Colin's reputation and popularity would be interested in a woman of Penelope's reputation and lack of popularity. Colin's mood shifted from bad to foul.
Anyway,
Eloise continued, completely oblivious to the thunderstorm that was brewing in her normally sunny and jovial brother.
Felicity told Hyacinth that Briley told her that you'd visited. I was just wondering what it was about.
It's none of your business,
Colin said briskly, hoping she'd leave it at that, but not really believing she would. He took a step toward the stairwell, though, always optimistic.
It's about my birthday, isn't it?
Eloise guessed,
dashing in front of him with such suddenness that his toe crashed into her slipper. She winced, but Colin didn't feel particularly sympathetic.
"No, it's not about your birthday," he snapped. "Your birthday isn't even until..."
He stopped. Oh, hell.
"Until next week," he grumbled.
She smiled slyly. Then, as if her brain had just realised it had taken a wrong turn, her lips parted with dismay as she mentally backed up and headed in another direction. "So," she continued, moving slightly so that she better blocked his path, "if you didn't go over there to discuss my birthday, and there's nothing you could say now that would convince me you did, why did you go see Penelope?"
"Is nothing private in this world?"
"Not in this family." Colin decided that his best bet was to adopt his usual sunny persona, even though he didn't feel the least bit charitable toward her at the moment, and so he slapped on the smoothest and easiest of his smiles, quirked his head to the side, and asked,
"Do I hear Mother calling my name?"
"I didn't hear a thing," Eloise said pertly. "And what is wrong with you? You look very odd."
"I'm fine."
"You're not fine. You look as if you've been to the dentist." His voice descended into a mutter.
"It's always nice to receive compliments from family."
"If you can't trust your family to be honest with you," she volleyed, "who can you trust?"
He leaned fluently back against the wall, crossing his arms. "I prefer flattery to honesty."
"No, you don't."
Dear God, he wanted to smack her. He hadn't done that since he was 12, and he'd been horsewhipped for it. The only time he could recall his father laying a hand on him. "What I want," Colin returned, arching one brow, "is an immediate cessation of this conversation."
"What do you want," Eloise needled, "is for me to stop asking you why you went to see Penelope Featherington. But I think we both know that isn't likely to occur."
And that was when he knew it. Knew it deep in his bones, from his head to his toes, his heart to his mind, that his sister was Lady Whistledown. All of the pieces fit. There was no one more stubborn and bull-headed, no one who could, or would, take the time to get to the bottom of every last piece of gossip and innuendo. When Eloise wanted something, she didn't stop until she had it firmly in her grasp. It wasn't about money, or greed, or material goods. With her it was about knowledge. She liked knowing things, and she'd needle and needle and needle until you'd told her exactly what she wanted to hear. It was a miracle no one had found her out sooner. Out of nowhere, he said, "I need to talk to you." He grabbed her arm and hauled her into the nearest room, which happened to be her own.
"Colin!"
she shrieked, trying unsuccessfully to shake him off.
"What are you doing?"
He slammed the door shut, let go of her, and crossed his arms, his stance wide, his expression menacing.
"Colin!"
she repeated, her voice dubious.
"I know what you've been up to."
"What I've been?"
And then, damn her, she started laughing.
"Eloise!" he boomed. "I'm talking to you."
"Clearly."
She just barely managed to get out. He held his ground, glaring at her. She was looking away, nearly doubled over with laughter. Finally, she said,
"What are you..."
But then she looked at him again, and even though she'd tried to keep her mouth shut, she exploded again. If she'd been drinking something, Colin thought, without a trace of humour, it would have come out her nose.
"What the hell is the matter with you?" he snapped.
That finally got her attention. He didn't know whether it was his tone of voice, or maybe his use of profanity, but she sobered in an instant.
"My word," she said softly. "You're serious."
"Do I look like I'm joking?"
"No,"
Eloise said.
"Although you did at first. I'm sorry, Colin, but it's just not like you to be glowering and yelling and all that. You looked rather like Antony.
You...
Actually,
she said, giving him a look that was not nearly as wary as it should have been.
You looked more like yourself, trying to imitate Antony.
He was going to kill her. Right here in her room, in his mother's house, he was going to commit sororicide.
Colin,
she asked hesitantly, as if she'd just finally noticed that he had long since passed angry on his way to furious.
Sit down.
He jerked his head toward a chair. Now.
Are you all right?
Sit down,
he roared. And she did, with alacrity.
I can't remember the last time you raised your voice,
she whispered.
I can't remember the last time I had cause to.
What's wrong?
He decided he might as well just come out and say it.
Colin?
I know you're Lady Whistledown.
What?
There's no use denying it. I've seen...
Eloise jumped to her feet.
Except that it's not true.
Suddenly, he no longer felt quite so angry. Instead, he felt tired, old.
Eloise, I've seen the proof.
What proof?
She asked, her voice rising with disbelief.
How can there be proof of something that isn't true?
He grabbed one of her hands. Look at your fingers. She did so.
What about them?
Ink stains.
Her mouth fell open.
From that you've deduced that I'm Lady Whistledown.
Why are they there, then?
You've never used a quill?
Eloise!
There was a great deal of warning in his voice.
I don't have to tell you why I have ink stains on my fingers.
He said her name again.
I don't!
She protested.
I owe you no... Oh, very well. Fine.
She crossed her arms mutinously.
I write letters.
He shot her an extremely disbelieving look.
I do,
she protested.
Every day. Sometimes two in a day when Francesca is away. I'm quite a loyal correspondent. You should know. I've written enough letters with your name on the envelope, although I doubt half of them ever reached you.
Letters? He asked, his voice full of doubt and derision.
For God's sake, Eloise, do you really think that will wash? Who the devil are you writing so many letters to?
She blushed. Really, truly, deeply blushed.
It's none of your business.
He would have been intrigued by her reaction if he still weren't so sure that she was lying about being Lady Whistledown.
For God's sake, Eloise,
he bit off.
Who is going to believe that you're writing letters every day? I certainly don't.
She glared at him, her dark grey eyes flashing with fury.
I don't care what you think,
she said in a very low voice.
No, that's not true. I am furious that you don't believe me.
You're not giving me much to believe in,
he said wearily. She stood, walked over to him, and poked him in the chest, hard.
You are my brother,
she spat out.
You should believe me unquestioningly, love me unconditionally. That's what it means to be family.
Eloise,
he said, her name coming out really as nothing more than a sigh.
Don't try to make excuses now.
I wasn't.
That's even worse.
She stalked to the door.
You should be on your hands and knees, begging me for forgiveness.
He hadn't thought he had it in him to smile, but somehow that did it for him.
Now, that doesn't really seem in keeping with my character, does it?
She opened her mouth to say something, but the sound that came out was not precisely English. All she managed was something along the lines of,
"Ooh!"
in an extremely irate voice, and then she stormed out, slamming the door behind her. Colin slouched into a chair, wondering when she'd realise that she'd left him in her own bedchamber. The irony was, he reflected,
possibly the only bright spot in an otherwise miserable day. Chapter 10. Dear reader, it is with a surprisingly sentimental heart that I write these words. After 11 years of chronicling the lives and times of the Beau Monde, this author is putting down her pen. Although Lady Danbury's challenge was surely the catalyst for the retirement, in truth the blame cannot be placed entirely upon that Countess's shoulders. The column has grown wearisome of late, less fulfilling to write, and perhaps less entertaining to read. This author needs a change. It is not so difficult to fathom. 11 years is a long time. And, in truth, the recent renewal of interest in this author's identity has grown disturbing. Friends are turning against friends, brothers against sisters, all in the futile attempt to solve an unsolvable secret. Furthermore, the sleuthing of the ton has grown downright dangerous. Last week it was Lady Blackwood's twisted ankle. This week's injury apparently belongs to Hyacinth Bridgerton, who was slightly hurt at Saturday's soiree held at the London home of Lord and Lady Riverdale. It has not escaped this author's notice that Lord Riverdale is Lady Danbury's nephew. Miss Hyacinth must have suspected someone in attendance, because she sustained her injuries while falling into the library after the door was opened, while she had her ear pressed up to the wood. Listening at doors, chasing down delivery boys, and these are only the tidbits that have reached this author's ears. What has London society come to? This author assures you, dear reader, that she never once listened at a door in all 11 years of her career. All gossip in this column was come by fairly, with no tools or tricks other than keen eyes and ears. I bid you au revoir, London. It has been a pleasure to serve you. Lady Whistledown's Society Papers, 19th of April, 1824. It was, not surprisingly, the talk of the Macclesfield Ball.
Lady Whistledown has retired!
Can you believe it? What will I read with my breakfast?
How will I know what happened if I miss a party?
We'll never find out who she is now. Lady Whistledown has retired! One woman fainted, nearly cracking her head against the side of a table as she slumped gracelessly to the floor. Apparently, she had not read that morning's column, and thus heard the news for the first time right there at the Macclesfield Ball. She was revived by smelling salts, but then quickly swooned again.
She's a faker,
Hyacinth Bridgerton muttered to Felicity Featherington as they stood in a small group with the Dowager Lady Bridgerton and Penelope. Penelope was officially attending as Felicity's chaperone due to their mother's decision to remain home with an upset stomach.
The first faint was real,
Hyacinth explained.
Anyone could tell that by the clumsy way she fell. But this...
Her hand flicked toward the lady on the floor with a gesture of disgust.
No one swoons like a ballet dancer, not even ballet dancers.
Penelope had overheard the entire conversation, as Hyacinth was directly to her left, and so she murmured,
Have you ever swooned?
All the while keeping her eyes on the unfortunate woman, who was now coming awake with a delicate fluttering of eyelashes, as the smelling salts were once again wafted under her nose.
Absolutely not,
Hyacinth replied, with no small measure of pride.
Swoons are for the tender-hearted and foolish, she added. And if Lady Whistledown was still writing, mark my words, she would say the exact same thing in her next column.
Alas, there are no words to mark any more, Felicity answered with a sad sigh. Lady Bridgerton agreed. It's the end of an era, she said. I feel quite bereft without her.
Well, it's not as if we've had to go more than 18 hours without her yet,
Penelope felt compelled to point out.
We did receive a column this morning. What is there yet to feel bereft about?
It's the principle of it, Lady Bridgerton said with a sigh. If this were an ordinary Monday, I would know that I'd receive a new report on Wednesday. But now... Felicity actually sniffled.
Now we're lost, she said.
Penelope turned to her sister in disbelief.
Surely you're being a little melodramatic.
Felicity's overblown shrug was worthy of the stage.
Am I?
Hyacinth gave her a sympathetic pat on the back.
I don't think you are, Felicity. I feel precisely the same way.
It's only a gossip column,
Penelope said, looking around for any sign of sanity in her companions. Surely they realized that the world was not drawing to a close just because Lady Whistledown had decided to end her career.
You're right, of course,
said Lady Bridgerton, jutting her chin out and pursing her lips in a manner that was probably supposed to convey an air of practicality.
Thank you for being the voice of reason for our little party.
But then she seemed to deflate slightly, and she said, But I must admit, I'd grown rather used to having her around, whoever she is. Penelope decided it was well past time to change the topic.
Where is Eloise this evening?
Ill, I'm afraid. A headache, Lady Bridgerton said, small frowns of worry creasing her otherwise unlined face. She hasn't been feeling the thing for almost a week now. I'm starting to grow concerned about her. Penelope had been staring rather aimlessly at a sconce on the wall, but her attention was immediately brought back to Lady Bridgerton.
It's nothing serious, I hope. It's nothing serious,
Hyacinth answered, before her mother could even open her mouth.
Eloise never gets sick.
Which is precisely why I'm worried, Lady Bridgerton said. She hasn't been eating very well.
That's not true,
Hyacinth said.
Just this afternoon Wickham brought up a very heavy tray. Scones and eggs, and I think I smelled gammon steak.
She gave an arch look to no one in particular.
And when Eloise left the tray out in the hall, it was completely empty.
Hyacinth Bridgerton, Penelope decided, had a surprisingly good eye for detail.
She's been in a bad mood, Hyacinth continued, since she quarrelled with Colin.
She quarrelled with Colin?
Penelope asked, an awful feeling beginning to roil her stomach.
When?
Sometime last week,
Hyacinth said. When? Penelope wanted to scream, but surely it would look odd if she demanded an exact day. Was it Friday? Was it? Penelope would always remember that her first, and most probably only, kiss had occurred on a Friday. She was strange that way. She always remembered the days of the week. She'd met Colin on a Monday. She'd kissed him on a Friday. 12 years later. She sighed. It seemed fairly pathetic.
Is something wrong, Penelope?
Lady Bridgerton asked. Penelope looked at Eloise's mother. Her blue eyes were kind and filled with concern, and there was something about the way she tilted her head to the side that made Penelope want to cry. She was getting far too emotional these days. Crying over the tilt of her head.
I'm fine, she said, hoping that her smile looked true. I'm just worried about Eloise.
Hyacinth snorted. Penelope decided she needed to make her escape. All these Bridgertons, well, two of them anyway, were making her think of Colin, which wasn't anything she hadn't been doing nearly every minute of the day for the past 3 days. But at least that had been in private, where she could sigh and moan and grumble to her heart's content. But this must have been her lucky night, because just then she heard Lady Danbury barking her name. What was her world coming to, that she considered herself lucky to be trapped in a corner with London's most acerbic tongue? But Lady Danbury would provide the perfect excuse to leave her current little quartet of ladies, and besides, she was coming to realise that in a very odd way she rather liked Lady Danbury.
Miss Featherington! Miss Featherington!
Felicity instantly took a step away.
I think she means you, she whispered urgently.
Of course she means me, Penelope said, with just a touch of hauteur.
I consider Lady Danbury a cherished friend.
Felicity's eyes bugged out.
You do?
Miss Featherington,
Lady Danbury said, thumping her cane an inch away from Penelope's foot as soon as she reached her side.
Not you, she said to Felicity,
even though Felicity had done nothing more than smile politely as the Countess had approached.
You, she said to Penelope.
Good evening, Lady Danbury,
Penelope said, which she considered an admirable number of words under the circumstances.
I have been looking for you all evening,
Lady D announced. Penelope found that a trifle surprising.
You have?
Yes. I want to talk with you about that Whistledown woman's last column.
Me?
Yes, you, Lady Danbury grumbled. I'd be happy to talk with someone else if you could find me a body with more than half a brain.
Penelope choked on the beginnings of laughter as she motioned to her companions.
I assure you that Lady Bridgerton...
Lady Bridgerton was furiously shaking her head.
She's too busy trying to get that oversized brood of hers married off,
Lady Danbury announced.
Can't be expected to know how to conduct a decent conversation these days.
Penelope stole a frantic glance over at Lady Bridgerton to see if she was upset by the insult. After all, she had been trying to marry off her oversized brood for a decade now. But Lady Bridgerton didn't look the least bit upset. In fact, she appeared to be stifling laughter. Stifling laughter and inching away, taking Hyacinth and Felicity with her. Sneaky little traitors. Oh, well, Penelope shouldn't complain. She'd wanted an escape from the Bridgertons, hadn't she? But she didn't particularly enjoy having Felicity and Hyacinth think they'd somehow pulled one over on her.
They're gone now, Lady Danbury cackled. And a good thing it is, too. Those two girls haven't an intelligent thing to say between them.
Oh, now that isn't true,
Penelope felt compelled to protest.
Felicity and Hyacinth are both very bright.
I never said they weren't smart, Lady D replied acidly. Just that they haven't an intelligent thing to say. But don't worry, she added,
giving Penelope a reassuring... Reassuring? Who ever heard of Lady Danbury being reassuring? Pat on the arm.
It's not their fault that their conversation is useless. They'll grow out of it. People are like fine wines. If they start off good, they only get better with age.
Penelope had actually been glancing slightly to the right of Lady Danbury's face, peering over her shoulder at a man who she thought might be Colin, but wasn't. But this brought her attention right back to where the Countess wanted it.
Fine wines, Penelope echoed.
And here I thought you weren't listening.
No, of course I was listening.
Penelope felt her lips tugging into something that wasn't quite a smile.
I was just distracted.
Looking for that Bridgerton boy, no doubt.
Penelope gasped.
Oh, don't look so shocked. It's written all over your face. I'm just surprised he hasn't noticed.
I imagine he has,
Penelope mumbled.
Has he?
Lady Danbury frowned, the corners of her mouth spilling into long vertical wrinkles on either side of her chin.
Doesn't speak well of him that he hasn't done anything about it.
Penelope's heart ached. There was something oddly sweet about the old lady's faith in her, as if men like Colin fell in love with women like Penelope on a regular basis. Penelope had had to beg him to kiss her, for heaven's sake, and look how that had ended up. He'd left the house in a fit of temper, and they hadn't spoken for 3 days.
"Well, don't worry over him,"
Lady Danbury said quite suddenly.
"We'll find you someone else."
Penelope delicately cleared her throat.
"Lady Danbury, have you made me your project?"
The old lady beamed, her smile a bright and glowing streak in her wrinkled face.
"Of course.
I'm surprised it has taken you so long to figure it out.
But why? Penelope asked, truly unable to fathom it. Lady Danbury sighed. The sound wasn't sad, more wistful, really.
Would you mind if we sat down for a spell? These old bones aren't what they used to be.
Of course, Penelope said quickly, feeling terrible that she'd never once considered Lady Danbury's age as they stood there in the stuffy ballroom. But the Countess was so vibrant, it was difficult to imagine her ailing or weak.
Here we are,
Penelope said, taking her arm and leading her to a nearby chair. Once Lady Danbury was settled, Penelope took a seat beside her.
Are you more comfortable now? Would you like something to drink?
Lady Danbury nodded gratefully, and Penelope signalled to a footman to bring them two glasses of lemonade, since she didn't want to leave the Countess while she was looking so pale.
I'm not as young as I used to be,
Lady Danbury told her, once the footman had hied off to the refreshment table.
None of us are,
Penelope replied. It could have been a flip comment, but it was spoken with wry warmth. And somehow Penelope thought that Lady Danbury would appreciate the sentiment. She was right. Lady D chuckled and sent Penelope an appreciative glance before saying,
The older I get, the more I realise that most of the people in this world are fools.
You're only just figuring that out now,
Penelope asked, not to mock, but rather because, given Lady Danbury's usual demeanour, it was difficult to believe that she hadn't reached that conclusion years ago. Lady Danbury laughed heartily.
No! Sometimes I think I knew that before I was born. What I'm realising now is that it's time I did something about it.
What do you mean?
I couldn't care less what happens to the fools of this world, but the people like you...
Lacking a handkerchief, she dabbed at her eyes with her fingers.
Well, I'd like to see you settled.
For several seconds, Penelope did nothing but stare at her.
Lady Danbury, she said carefully, I very much appreciate the gesture and the sentiment, but you must know that I am not your responsibility.
Of course I know that, Lady Danbury scoffed. Have no fear. I feel no responsibility to you. If I did, this wouldn't be half so much fun.
Penelope knew she sounded the veriest ninny, but all she could think to say was,
I don't understand.
Lady Danbury held silent while the footman returned with their lemonade, then began speaking once she had taken several small sips.
I like you, Miss Featherington. I don't like a lot of people. It's as simple as that, and I want to see you happy.
But I am happy, Penelope said, more out of reflex than anything else.
Lady Danbury raised one arrogant brow, an expression that she did to perfection.
Are you?
She murmured. Was she? What did it mean that she had to stop and think about the answer? She wasn't unhappy, of that she was sure. She had wonderful friends, a true confidant in her younger sister Felicity, and if her mother and older sisters weren't women she'd have chosen as close friends, well, she still loved them, and she knew they loved her. Hers wasn't such a bad lot. Her life lacked drama and excitement, but she was content. But contentment wasn't the same thing as happiness. And she felt a sharp, stabbing pain in her chest as she realised that she could not answer Lady Danbury's softly worded question in the affirmative.
I've raised my family, Lady Danbury said. 4 children, and they all married well. I even found a bride for my nephew, who, truth be told...
She leaned in and whispered the last 3 words, giving Penelope the impression that she was about to divulge a state secret.
I like better than my own children.
Penelope couldn't help but smile. Lady Danbury looked so furtive, so naughty. It was rather cute, actually.
It may surprise you, Lady Danbury continued, but by nature I'm a bit of a meddler.